Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday morning, the 2nd of June. Our guest this hour is Professor Julian Zelizer, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School, author and editor of many books examining U.S. political leaders, policies, and institutions since the New Deal. His new book is Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terror, which is going to be published this fall. He writes extensively commentaries for CNN.com and has written some interesting ones. Well, he's always interesting because he has a terrific mind. But this hour, we're going to be looking at a couple of his recent commentaries, starting with what is very much in the news this week, and that is the nomination of Judge Sotomayor to the Supreme Court. He talks about the history of the Republican Party in a recent commentary on CNN and says that the debate about her nomination is in many ways a strategic debate about the future of the Republican Party. There are two paths rooted in history that the GOP could follow. One is the model of Dwight Eisenhower and the other is the model of Barry Goldwater. And we'll be talking about what he means by that. He has also written about national security. We'll be talking, of course, about President Obama's big trip to the Middle East, where he's going to be delivering a speech on June 4 in the most populous Arab state, Egypt. And this is an important event for the United States. So we'll be talking about that. We'll be looking at the future of newspapers and the internet. We have a lot to talk about with Professor Zelizer, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls as we always do. He's one of our more popular guests. So call in early. The number is 800-486-8655. And the email, we already have one of those. For more of those, you can send an email at talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Professor Zelizer, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Let's talk about Dwight Eisenhower and Barry Goldwater. What are those paths rooted in history that the GOP could follow, and what are they most likely to follow?
Well, the point of the article is Dwight Eisenhower was one model where he really tried to build a very broad coalition for the Republican Party. He envisioned it, you know, as being as powerful as what FDR did. So he tried to bring in new groups of voters that would include everyone from, you know, moderates in the Northeast to independents. In many ways, that was what he had been, to Southern Democrats, who he's able to attract. And in 1956, he does extraordinarily well against Adlai Stevenson, and he ends his presidency as one of the most popular presidents we've had. And, you know, he wasn't just a Democrat. He accepted a lot of the New Deal and said Republicans had to live with things like Social Security, but he also championed issues like fiscal conservatism and took on Democrats on those issues. Barry Goldwater was very different. He believed in playing to the conservative base of the party, abandoning the idea that you should be moderate or independent, and really trying to craft a Republican Party that was defined by conservatism rather than a coalitional approach to politics. So there's two competing visions we've seen. Since the 60s, Republicans have really focused on the latter model.
Mm-hmm. What about Ronald Reagan? What about the first Bush, the second Bush?
Ronald Reagan was different. I mean, Ronald Reagan, he was a little more like Eisenhower, but many conservatives are quite angry with him for much of what he does. We forget about this. Early on, many social conservatives say he's abandoned them and he really isn't taking their issues seriously. Many are unhappy. He raises taxes after his first few years in office. And when Reagan tries to achieve and does achieve detente with the Soviet Union, some Republicans and conservative activists are literally using the terms of Munich and appeasement to describe what he's doing. And so Republicans then in the 90s kind of go back to the Goldwater approach. That was part of what the 94 congressional takeover was by Republicans, you know, ally with conservative activists. George W. Bush, initially talks about conservative, compassionate conservatism and building a coalition with groups like Hispanics, but he quickly abandoned that approach. So Reagan's really kind of exceptional, and he was on his own in many ways in what he tried to do in tapping into that Eisenhower model. But it really hasn't been the dominant way Republicans have been thinking for a while.
You talk about the polls that show the public standing of Republicans has really fallen dramatically in these constituencies that the GOP had hoped to attract. And we think most recently of Bush, who tried to attract this vote, are Hispanic voters steadily moving toward the Democratic Party. And so Obama's selection of Sotomayor threatens, you say, to permanently secure that community's support for Democrats.
Yeah, that was really one of the kind of forgotten ambitions of President Bush, was to bring in Hispanic voters into the Republican Party and make them a key part of the coalition. He'd done some of this in Texas while he was governor, and it was genuine. I mean, the more we read about Bush's history, the more genuine that seemed. He really did think that Republicans could attract Hispanic voters. But it didn't work out that way because of kind of the stalemate over immigration and the renewal of a hardline anti-immigration stance during the Bush years. Hispanic voters by the Obama election in 2008 were moving to the Democratic Party at pretty dramatic numbers. I think this nomination is raising that issue again. And I think some of the responses by Republicans like Newt Gingrich and some others is going to exacerbate, this kind of tension between Republicans and Hispanic voters. I think the hardline stance that some Republicans are trying to take, not all, but some spokesmen are taking against this nomination could be very damaging politically, again, regardless of whether she's affirmed or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, what really caught my attention was when attacks started coming forward about her intelligence. Maybe she's not intelligent enough. And I'm thinking, whoa, wait a second. She's gone to these top-notch Ivy League schools. She's been a judge all of these years. I don't think intelligence is in question here, is it?
No, not at all. I mean, there's almost no support for this idea that she is not qualified to take on this job in terms of her intelligence. Her record is really as stellar as any we've seen on the court. It's what you'd want, really, for a Supreme Court justice to have. And all accounts of justices who have worked with her and many of her clerks, most of her clerks, kind of have agreed with this. That's not really an issue, and it was surprising. It came from an article in the New Republic by one of their writers, and this was the first story they picked up, really, I don't think spoke well to the spokesmen who were using that line of attack. Republicans have moved on from that in general, but now they're focusing on affirmative action, on that as the way to challenge her. And I think that, too, poses a danger. Right now, to make this a debate about affirmative action can also be very politically costly to the Republican Party.
And yet she'll be ruling on affirmative action issues, right? She already has.
She has, of course. I mean, anyone in her position will. And there's this one case, which is now the source of contention involving New Haven and a firefighter, where tests were ultimately rejected because of affirmative action. So, and the Supreme Court is going to rule on this probably before she's confirmed. Might overturn the decision her court made. Again, she was with other justices on this. So that case will be brought up. But again, if the Republican opponents really want to seriously do it, I think they'll have to look at all her cases. There's evidence she's ruled in many different ways, depending on the case. And again, that the Republicans have to think about, is this the time they want to kind of bring back the debates over affirmative action? Right now, when the Republicans are out of power, are struggling to rebuild a new image, when an African-American president appoints a Hispanic nominee who's extraordinarily talented, do they want to make on television affirmative action, race, immigration, their central issue, or do they want to focus on kind of different questions?
Have the Republicans, though, succeeded in making this area the central issue that certainly the press has this comment about the benefits of a Latina judge that she made many years ago have been played over and over and over again? Have they captured what the debate is?
They have an issue, of course, yes. I think that the wise woman comment was something that the media picked up on, and Republicans have been able to, you know, foster a certain amount of interest and excitement about among conservatives. But it's not always clear that when you get an issue circulated and get attention for an issue, that it benefits the person attacking. Sometimes it can backfire on you, even if it's not apparent at the moment. I think a lot of Republicans have been quite quiet about this, including many congressional Republicans who are not supporting what they're hearing on the radio and what they're hearing from Newt Gingrich. And it's pretty striking, the silences you've heard. And I think a lot of Republicans, even if this is working, even if this is part of how the nomination is being defined, are not comfortable with this being the Republican strategy. And again, she's probably going to be confirmed. That's where all the numbers are right now. And so, I'm not sure getting attention is equivalent to winning in politics. We've seen this before. It was like back in 95 and 96, Newt Gingrich got a lot of attention for the budget showdown against President Clinton when they shut down the federal government, demanding cuts. But in the end, it backfired on the party. It looked like they couldn't govern. It looked like they were too extreme. And Clinton's popularity surged, and he had kind of much more power than he might otherwise have had.
And what about the Democrats, Professor Zelizer? What questions do they have about her? What do you think needs to be asked by the Democrats?
It depends. There's some divisions. I think the Democrats have to ask some serious questions. I think they've raised a bunch of questions about the court in the past few years, issues involving executive power, for example. Democrats have made this a big issue. Executive power has expanded. We need more restraints on executive power. So, I think it would be a little unsatisfying for many Democratic supporters if during these confirmation hearings we don't hear what her positions are or how she's thinking about this issue as it relates to national security. We want to hear from her what she thinks about the kind of questions that have arisen about the rights of detainees and what's the balance between civil liberties and national security questions. And obviously, they too want to hear what her thoughts are on these questions of affirmative action. I mean, traditionally, we won't hear anything from her. I mean, they're very good at kind of avoiding specific answers. But I think the executive power and national security questions would be very important for Democrats to get out there.
Mm-hmm. Because national security is an important issue for Democrats to regain control of?
Yeah, also because, they have made this a central claim against the Bush administration. And they have argued that when the court has kind of tried to check the Bush administration, this has been a good thing, a needed thing in this country, that this has to be part of how we approach national security with more restraints on what we do. And so if they want to make that the case, and they have, it's incumbent on them to actually ask their nominee how she would think about these questions in the future.
Let's go to some phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. John from Madison, our first caller. Hi, John.
Hey, guys. Say, I'm a David Brooksian moderate, so this is probably self-serving, but don't you think the GOP is just blowing it again? I mean, look, she's going to get confirmed. And instead of trying to parse out some statement she made to, figure out, oh, she's some crypto racist, I mean, she was having a serious discussion about race. It's not like somebody said, let's go get ice cream, and she said, no, white people are there. It was a serious discussion about race. And the GOP could have a wonderful conversation about, look, people say things in context about a serious subject. That should not be uniquely disqualifying simply because it's about race. This will turn around and help the GOP when they have a president who can seat some justice and they say, look, we gave your person a fair shake. We had an open dialogue about this. People disagree. But it would elevate the GOP and build credibility with them, which I think this is a golden opportunity for the Democrats to build on the credibility that Barack Obama established, which is, look, my policies may be far more liberal than many are comfortable with, but I'm going to discuss them in a sober and reasonable, non-inflammatory way. And the Democrats, if they look at Sotomayor and question her about this issue, they can come out just golden on this, saying, look, we too have concerns about somebody with an inherent bias in their judicial philosophy. Do you have that? Explain why you don't and how you would treat these issues. So, the GOP, they just can't stop stepping on themselves on this. I guess it's more of an observation than a question, but, I'd be interested in your response.
Well, I think that's a good point, and there's several responses and several ideas. The first is, I think you're right, and I think the Republicans have you know, taken the worst political approach to this. They're not really dealing with the issues. They're dealing with these kind of scattershot attacks against her. And even when dealing with the question of, like, what does she think about affirmative action? What should our affirmative action policies be? Instead, they're kind of using this, you know, snippet from a speech to present her as Gingrich said, as, you know, kind of a reverse racist, which I think many Americans are not going to like hearing that. It certainly doesn't ring true for most Americans. And so I think it reflects a Republican Party that is a bit in disarray, or very much in disarray, where there's not clear leadership, where there's not clear ideas about where the party should be going. And this is the kind of politics you then get. It opens up room for this kind of debate. Second, you're right. I mean, there could be a confirmation hearing when Democrats do ask what those comments meant, as do more kind of reasoned Republicans. What should the role of a justice's experience have been? You know, what do you actually bring when you're dealing with the law? They could do that. I'm not, you know, that's a debate probably we could have for every person who's nominated.
Right.
I don't know if that's where we want to focus our attention. And most law schools is kind of agreement that a judge is a person, and they bring with them their life experiences, and that's true of everyone at this point.
Yes. Let's talk a little bit more about those moderate Republicans. Why don't they grab the microphone here? Is it their fault, or is it the fault of the press to constantly have Newt Gingrich on the air? Rush Limbaugh, I've seen him once, I've seen him a million times the last 2 weeks on this particular issue. Where are the moderates who have a different point of view? Are they in such disarray they can't find a spokesperson? I mean, I've heard the voices, but nowhere near as often as Rush Limbaugh's.
Well, some of them, I mean, part of it is the press, and this works on both sides of the aisle. The press does like, you know, comments that are going to attract attention. If you're running a 24-hour media internet site, you're going to want a quote that is going to get readers to your site rather than the other site. And so moderates often are boring. They don't say things that will elicit that kind of attention. And so I think there is a media-driven aspect to it. I think some moderates are, on this debate, are not comfortable with what their party is doing. And so instead of stepping up and taking a different response, they're being silent. And they're either kind of quietly, if they're in Congress, saying, we're not going to make this one of our major fights, and not realizing that then Newt Gingrich becomes the face of the party, or Rush Limbaugh, or, you know, they're kind of not, they're not being heard. They have no voice. They have no leadership voice in the party. You need a leader to represent you. And it's unclear who the moderate Republicans are right now who are going to express those opinions.
John, thanks for the call. Steve is next from Houston, Texas. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, good morning. Hi. I have two comments. You know, she would not have been the first nominee of the Supreme Court if I think President Bush would have had his way, because Miguel Estrada, Honduran immigrant, who was basically nuked out of the water with what many people consider a character assassination by Mr. Schumer, calling him a right-wing stealth bomb or something like that. And, you know, he was taken down by people in the media before he had a chance to be nominated. And that was intentional. A lot of people would argue that, you know, President Bush clearly would have nominated him, or perhaps some other Hispanic people, but they saw that it didn't happen. So it's not fair to say that this is race baiting. But my second comment is, you know, given the statements by the nominee, you know, it's clearly just, it's inflammatory, you know, to comment about white males. I mean, if that's not inflammatory, what is? But, you know, why is it that we can't have a debate about comments like this? If you look at the character assassination of Robert Bork, of Clarence Thomas, of Sarah Palin, why is the Democrats can get away with this with anybody who is African-American, is white, who is Hispanic? But when Republicans do it, it's called race baiting. Your guest sounds like a spokesman for the Democratic Party. You know, why don't you deal with the real issues at hand? You know, Orrin Hatch hasn't had his say yet on this nomination, but he's not a man who makes inflammatory statements. He's an incredible temperament, and he's going to raise these issues. And I challenge the Democrats to answer the questions about, you know, what she feels is the role of the judiciary. She sounds like an activist to me.
Professor Zelzer.
Those are fair comments. I think one thing to remember is that the confirmation process has been partisan for many decades. And the caller is right. It's not a Republican issue. Both sides have politicized this, particularly since the late 1960s, to the point where so much of this debate happens up front, as it is right now, and it has happened with Republican appointees, before you know anything about a nominee. I think the way in which this quote has worked is reflective of that. Most people have never actually read the speech. Most people don't really know the kinds of arguments she was talking about, yet they have very strong opinions about, you know, whatever, three or four words of a speech, and are saying whether she should be on the court or not. That reflects a kind of process that is not the best way to nominate and to appoint someone to the approve someone for the Supreme Court. And so I think there is a bipartisan element in this. Not that we have bipartisanship, but there's a bipartisan agreement to be partisan. And so we need to think about that for the future, and we need to think of ways, if possible, to improve that. And there certainly have been these kinds of attacks on Republicans as well. This is not a Democratic or Republican issue. So the process is flawed. Second, you know, the quotation again, I think the basic message she was trying to make is that justices bring with them to the court their life experiences, and when they interpret law, that is going to influence how they think about legal questions. And, you know, there's quotes from Justice Alito, who said the same thing during his confirmation hearings. And again, you could find conservative and liberal commentators and legal scholars who agree with this as well. And I think the point was, you know, on certain issues, someone who's more familiar with certain kinds of racism or discrimination or immigration questions might be more sensitive to or bring a different kind of nuance to legal interpretation than someone who is a white male who's had a different life experience. Again, I don't think it was the most controversial statement, but I think, you know, this is how these quotations are now played out. And again, there's nothing wrong if we could have a healthy discussion about the relationship between who a justice is, how they approach the law, and what kind of justice they will be on the Supreme Court. That would be fine, but it's going to be hard to do that in the kind of politicized process that we have.
More phone calls in a moment. Our lines are open, several of them, 800-486-8655. The email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Downer, and our guest, in case you're just tuning in, is Professor Julian Zelizer, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School, written extensively about U.S. political leaders, policies, and institutions in his forthcoming book, Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism, coming out this fall. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Professor Julian Zelizer is our guest. We'll go back to phone calls in a moment. We have an email that has come in from a regular listener who listens to us from Mexico. It seems to me that the GOP heavies are grasping at straws because they have so little they can truly criticize about how Obama is saving the country. Their strategy has been driven by a somewhat well-orchestrated but often not attempt to spin a negative perspective on anything the Obama administration is doing. My guess is that they will even be blaming the doctor's assassination in Kansas as a logical and justifiable reaction to Obama's speech at Notre Dame. Unfortunately, what was once a noble party has been taken over by a bunch of Looney Tunes. Sure makes me glad I'm an independent supporting Obama. My judgment is that he's heading toward being the best president we've ever had in my lifetime. Given that I'm almost 67, that's a hell of a long time, almost one quarter of the time our country has been independent from the Brits. Professor Zelizer.
Well, that's the other side of the debate. And clearly, you know, part of what you hear from Republicans is a frustration about the kind of popularity that the president is enjoying, even after unfolding a lot of his agenda, which I think many conservatives don't like. You know, there's the lack of leadership aspect of this, but there's also a frustration when a president is popular. And we've seen this again. Many Democrats felt this way in 2004 when President Bush was reelected, and were kind of very frustrated with that. And
same in when Clinton was popular in the late 1990s, and you couldn't understand that. And that often breeds nastier and more hostile type of rhetoric about all sorts of issues. But I think the one thing is there is a great debate taking place in this country right now, which is kind of being ignored because we're focused on this debate over Sotomayor, is you know, how do you revitalize an economy? And do we go with a very aggressive, expansive approach to intervention, which we're seeing from the Obama administration, or what might be another kind of argument and tact for Republicans, you know, do you have more market-based approaches? What are the dangers of what we're seeing from the administration? The irony is that debate's not taking place right now, and that might have been much more effective, but it's kind of the air is going toward this, you know, Sotomayor quote. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's another cost of this.
Mm-hmm. And so while she's making the rounds in Washington, he's off to Saudi Arabia and to Egypt. Can you talk just a little bit about this very important speech, which we've been hearing about for a long time, coming up on June 4 in Egypt? Will he be talking about the American image in the Middle East? What will he be talking about? Will the peace agreement between Israel and the Palestinians, will that be discussed if there can be some kind of significant peace agreement that has been going swimmingly, but I understand behind the scenes more has been accomplished. Tell me about the importance of this speech and what you hope he will address and why he's doing it.
Well, you have the speech and you have the behind-the-scenes discussions, and sometimes those conflict, and he has to be careful that he doesn't want to say things in a public speech that undermine any kinds of negotiations that are taking place right now, which we probably won't know about with Israel, with the Palestinians, or with other factions in the region. And so that's the balance that's going to be very difficult. Often there's a conflict between those two. But obviously, one of the messages he is aiming to kind of explain both to the world who's watching the speech, but also to Muslims in the Middle East, is that the administration will offer a new approach to relations with this region, and that he seeks to kind of change the tone of the relations that have existed in the past 8 years. This was part of his campaign, and I think that's part of what his message will be. So diplomacy, financial assistance will be part of how we build alliances in that region, not just military threats. A second, and this is the part we don't know if he'll say, is a call for human rights in that region. There are many Democrats and Republicans who say that Obama must make this a message. And this is not just about the Israeli-Palestinian issue, but in Arab countries with which we are allied, human rights are a big problem, including in Egypt. And the mystery is if Obama will use this opportunity to not just talk to the people of the Middle East, but also talk to the governments of the Middle East and say this administration also would like change. And finally, you know, I do think he will signal that he wants to find some resolution to the Arab-Israeli conflict. He won't want to say anything that inflames the situation, but I do think it will be part of his speech, part of his message, to make it clear to everyone that even though this administration is dealing with a fragile economy here, that is going to remain at the center of his agenda.
Let's go to more calls. Gene from Madison is next. Hi, Gene.
Hello. Yes. So I have a more philosophical question, I guess. My problem with the nominee and my problem with President Obama's view of justice is that I don't think personal experience should influence. I don't think your ethnic background or anything about the judge should influence it, because justice should ideally be blind and uniform for everyone, and the law is the law, basically. If the judge finds a book offensive, or if a judge finds some form of speech offensive because of their personal feeling, they shouldn't have the right to ban it. And it's, in essence, I think more of some of the problem that the conservative base has with the nominee and has with the concept of judicial activism is that justice should be blind. It shouldn't be biased or influenced by one's background. Do you have anything to say on that comment? I'm just kind of curious of that.
I think that's well stated. That is the philosophical question. I think usually when people talk about this, including her. I think the issue is kind of the ideal versus reality. And I think when the people who write about this, and her in her speech, I think realistically they're saying we strive for that. Justices strive to do that. And the best justices do the most they can to get that ideal. But in reality, the argument is people will still, those influences are impossible to check, and this is not, you know, usually we focus on non-white justices to understand where the influence is, but obviously we have a history on issues of race where white justices were blind, not kind of blind in terms of approaching the law technically, but blind to the realities they were dealing with or unwilling to confront them when dealing with issues of civil rights or earlier slavery. So I think it's ideals versus reality, and I think the realists just argue this is part of the process. And then our goal is to have justices who do their best to kind of remove their opinion as much as possible. But there's an acknowledgement that that is part of the process. So I think that's how the debate takes place, and that's usually what commentators say.
Thank you, Gene, for your call. Anne from Madison, hi.
Hi. I heard G. Gordon Liddy in Hawaii when I was looking for something to listen to on the radio, and he has an extremely insinuating, nasty way of smearing people. I think if we had responsible investigative journalism in this country, more than just a little bit of it, we would have people who countered these remarks like Sotomayor isn't very bright or that she's a racist. Every time people like Karl Rove, who has exhibited contempt of Congress repeatedly without any consequences to him, and Newt Gingrich, who asked for a divorce when his first wife was recovering from a cancer operation, and G. Gordon Liddy, who was part of the Watergate gang, you know, Rush Limbaugh, who's just a pig in every possible way, we ought to consider the source here. And people are forgetting, who are criticizing her, that equal rights for all is the law. It's part of the Constitution, and it's very important that Supreme Court nominees believe in the Constitution and uphold it, not that they be, mired in people's prejudices.
Well, we have, yes, there's kind of different opinions about the source, but again, it gets back to the same point. Who are the spokesmen who are emerging for the party? And to have G. Gordon Liddy and Rush Limbaugh as being the heads of the party, the voices of the party, I don't think politically is the best path for the party to take. It's been an element of Republican politics since the 60s, even since the 1950s in the early Cold War era, a more extremist approach to dealing with this issue. But if Republicans want to kind of mount a more credible attack, I think they need to focus on judicial questions. If they really want to give a fair kind of analysis of who she is, they can't look at one case. They can't look at one part of one speech. If they really want to deal with this issue, they need to look at her whole record as a judge, which gives very different views of who she is, I think, than this one case in New Haven. She's more mixed on issues of affirmative action. She's actually a pretty pragmatic centrist judge by almost every account. So kind of when the attacks come in and they pick, you know, one or two aspects of her career, I think it loses credibility that they're serious about, you know, avoiding personalizing this attack and looking just at the law. I don't think that's what this is about. These are political statements that are being made. And so there is a cost to Republicans about making this the public face of the party.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. I like the piece, and this is just a sideline. We'll talk about this extensively, I hope, in a future show. But you talk about in one of your commentaries about what's happening with the loss of newspapers and the press now being both a product and a cause of this political phenomena where we're very polarized and we pick something that's somewhat sensational and we are on it and on it and on it and on it. So we've got Fox on one end and we've got MSNBC on the other end. And what you're calling for is probably an American public who are pretty sophisticated about issues and a need to fund reporters, you say, who keep covering the story and strive for objectivity as much as possible. I think the press is somewhat to blame for all of this. We need what you suggest, fair-minded reporters digging out a story.
Yeah, I mean, the problem has been getting increasingly worse. It started really with cable television in the 1980s, and, you know, what you had was the advent of a 24-hour news cycle, which was then, you know, fueled by the Internet as well. And you know, different stations and different sites were competing for stories, and they like more polarized kinds of reporting. Scandal draws viewers, listeners, and readers more than rather sober kinds of stories about the major issues taking place. And what's happening now is more dangerous in that, you know, the big establishment news sources, such as the newspapers, are going broke and they're disappearing. So what you're left with are a large number of internet sites with reporters who tend to be not wedded at all to objectivity, or not even interested in trying to be objective. They draw their readers by being polemical, by being partisan, and you lack anyone funding, not anyone, but you lack many endowed sources funding this kind of reporting that we did have in previous eras. And so there is a danger, ultimately, that the media continues to drive this much as a process, and there's less space for politicians who are in the middle, or politicians who are right or left, but have a kind of more sober way about talking about their questions and talking about the issues. There's no outlet for them, and there's not a lot of journalists doing that. And then the public gets used to this. So there is this structural problem that I think we need to think about, not just who's doing the confirming, who's appointed, but in how Americans learn about the issues that are going on.
John from Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, I want to go back to Justice is Blind. I think I have an understanding of what Justice Sotomayor was talking about, and my examples would be if you look at slavery, or if you look at the interning of the Japanese during World War II, while there was no interning of the Germans. If at that time we had had a justice that was a black man, or if we had a justice that was a Japanese, I think that the U.S. Supreme Court would have come to better conclusions because of the input that those people could have given to the Supreme Court. Justice should normally be blind, but I think that everyday experiences of maybe a black man during slavery, or a Japanese when the Germans weren't being interned, but the Japanese were being interned, Japanese Americans were being interned, that would have made a dramatic difference in the outcomes of Supreme Court decisions.
I think that is the argument she was trying to make. I think that's right on target. I think, you know, what the response to that would need to be by an opponent is then challenging that somehow that wouldn't have made a difference. That the path we took on issues such as race until, you know, relatively recently in American history had nothing to do with the color and background of the justices who were dealing with those questions. And I think that would that's what they really need to respond to if this is seriously an issue that concerns them. But I think that's exactly the point. If you read the speech, that's what she was trying to say.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks, John. Let's go next to Earl from Medford. Hi, Earl.
Hi, Kathleen. Good morning. I wanted to shift gears a little bit to get back to national security.
Sure.
Because I'm still perplexed, and maybe the professor could help, why the Democrats voted against funding the closed Guantanamo, and then also against transferring Guantanamo detainees to the U.S., even to supermax prisons, where we already have domestic terrorists and some pretty bad apples. But why are they backpedaling on
That's
national
a good
security
question.
Like that?
Yeah, a good that, question.
That was a big I think that was a kind of embarrassing, tense week for the administration. And I think that's about tensions between Congress and the White House, Democrats in Congress and the White House. I think, you know, from what we have learned, many Democrats were just unhappy that there had been no plan given to Congress about how this would take place, how the transfer would take place, and the political kind of feedback to closing it started to intensify with arguments, you know, about how can you put these detainees in the heartland of the country, in facilities where they said, you know, it wouldn't be secure. And so I think the Democrats voted against that. I think it was a message to the administration at that point that you're going to have to lay out what's going to happen. You're going to have to share with us the plan much more clearly than you did. Because we're taking a lot of political flack for this, and they didn't feel informed. You see these kinds of tensions, by the way, in American history very often between a White House and their own legislators, meaning legislators of their own party. When you think everything should be smooth, often in united government it isn't. And so I think that's what happened on Guantanamo. I think ultimately Democrats would support the administration. They will support the administration. But it's a sign. The president, this was still a small week in terms of kind of political blow-ups. But the president has to be careful to nurture the Democrats on Capitol Hill and to protect them from this kind of political fallout, because they can do stuff like this to really trigger a week-long debate, which is what he faced as a result of that vote.
Was that an indication that the Republicans still own the national security issue?
I don't think so. I mean, I think the polls actually that came out that same week showed that's not the case anymore, that majority of voters were supporting Obama's approach on national security. They're looking to Democrats more than Republicans in terms of trust on national security questions. So I'm not sure that, you know, Republicans come out of that week somehow reflecting a public opinion that likes them more. But I do think, you know, Democrats are still skittish about that area where they often don't have an advantage, and they're still kind of remembering the politics of the post 9/11 period, where Republicans did do well with the public. But I think in some ways their memories and fears don't match where the public is anymore. And so I actually think, you know, the speech Obama gave was a first start, but the Democrats should do more to lay out what their national security agenda is. They haven't talked about it as much as they might, but I don't think the politics is where it had been in 2004-2003.
More calls in a moment. 800-486-8655. A couple lines are open. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Professor Julian Zelizer is our guest, and we go next to Daryl from Exonia. Hi, Daryl.
Hi. I just wanted to say that that lady that's running for Supreme Court, they keep misquoting her because I've seen it on the news, and she put a qualifier in there and said, "I would hope that I would make a better decision." So she, you know, to take it out of context and say she said she's going to make a better decision than a white guy. Well, she always added a qualifier. That's what I do with my kids. I say, you know, probably tomorrow we'll go to the zoo, but something might come up, and they'll say, "Oh, you said we're going to the zoo." No, I said probably, and she said, "I would hope that." So at least she's smart enough to add a qualifier in there. So to misquote her and say, "Oh, she's a racist and this and that," that's, you know, got to get the whole. You can't cut a sentence off in the middle and say, "Well, this is what somebody said."
Well, the great irony, I mean, I think a lot of her opponents are doing exactly what they don't want her to do. They're not actually looking at the record and trying to take a serious look at it. They're, through their own biases, picking and choosing and reaching conclusions about her already. So, you know, I think, you know, that's part of the element that many of her supporters, they haven't actually pointed that out, but I think that's how a lot of the criticism has developed, doing exactly what they don't want her to do.
Thanks, Daryl, unless there's something else on your mind.
No, that's what I wanted to say.
That's it. Thank you. Martha from Woodruff. Hi, Martha.
Hi. I have missed part of the show. Can you hear me?
Oh, sure.
Oh, good. I've missed part of the show, so I don't know if the speaker addressed this, but what was the context in which this comment was made? And the second comment I have to make is I urge people to go back and read a book from the 60s called Women's Reality by Anne Wilson Schaaf. And the point that she makes is that anybody who's part of a minority group sees things that the group in power does not see. So I just think I'd be interested in people's reaction to that.
I mean, I think the speech I believe was at the University of California at Berkeley. It was a lecture in which she made that speech. I think it was a law and cultural diversity lecture. It was called something like that. And the context of the speech, I think we've talked about in terms of what she was actually trying to say. I think a lot of the listeners, that, you know, have that, and we've talked about it. And that particular book, I actually am not familiar with, but there was kind of a literature that emerged in the 1960s about gender, about race, that, you know, really influenced how legal, how law schools taught the law for the next few decades at places like Yale and Harvard University, where most of our justices do come from. And I think that informed some of the comments she was making. It's kind of, again, it's rather standard stuff she was talking about. It wasn't very dramatic. It's what you would learn in almost all these classrooms at this point. But it reflects a lot of the literature that came out from those decades. Again, it was that literature was often a response to the biases of justices when it was a Supreme Court that was all white. And the bias wasn't clear. It wasn't stated, but it was still there. That was the point of a lot of the literature, that you can't just say, you know, a blind justice. It just doesn't work that way. So diversity, the function is to bring multiple experiences, multiple backgrounds, and then you actually get a better evaluation and analysis of the law, because it's not just biased toward one ethnicity or one race. That's how we reach the most objective decision-making. That was the argument. And so, you know, now I think we're still dealing with some of the backlash to that era.
Thank you, Martha, for your call. Edgar, oh my goodness. Hold on one second. Let's go to Edgar now from Stevens Point. Hi, Edgar.
Oh, hello. I have a question getting back to Israel and the peace process. We've been hearing a lot about Obama wanting to work for a peace agreement, and we've heard both him and Hillary Clinton talking about the need to stop settlement activity. I wanted your perspective on how politically feasible it is for Obama to put serious pressure on Israel to make real concessions.
It's as tough as every other president who's been trying to do this since the 1960s. Part of it has to do with just, you know, traditional intransigence in the region among all parties. Part of it has to do with the fragile state of the current Israeli government, which is built around a coalition, and Netanyahu, I think, is going to be nervous in some ways at going too much against settlements because it could fracture his coalition. I think in the end what we've seen is a regional coalition approach to dealing with this question is best. That's in part what Carter tried to achieve. It was one area of success for his administration. I think, you know, to win over the hearts and minds of the Israelis, that the United States will have to bring something to the table for them. It won't just be about threats and intimidation. And there's this question of Iran, which is a central concern for not only the Israelis, but many other countries in the region. And I think what Obama needs to look for, not just with Iran, but other questions of economic development in the region, where can kind of a regional coalition be built that includes Israel, that would bring benefits to the various parties in the coalition, but would also require concessions, including from Israel. And that's what he needs to strive for. But I think if he just deals with, we're going to threaten Israel with support or whatever until they stop settlements, I don't think that will work. I think he'll then face the failures of other presidents.
Thank you very much, Edgar, for your call. Let's go next to Steve from Madison. Hi, Steve.
I'd be curious to hear what the president will say concerning the escalation of slaughter in Afghanistan, Pakistan. Yesterday on BBC interview, I hear him talk about the 3,000 people killed by bin Laden. He knows that's a big lie. He knows that those buildings were exploded by...
Yeah, we're not getting into that. But there's another... Yeah, boy, it's one thing after another that he has to deal with. Pakistan and Afghanistan and all these huge fronts... policy, yep. And foreign aid and people dying and terrorism still abounding. My goodness.
It's tough being president. I mean, if you...
Yeah, right.
One of my favorite things to do in research is to listen to the Lyndon Johnson White House tapes, where you hear the president speaking to one person after another between 1963 to the late 1960s, and it's just amazing. The day is full, and it's not just a lot of work they do, but they go from one big issue to another within the span of an hour, within the span of the day. And, you know, whether you're in a moment like today, which is something of a crisis in terms of the economy, in terms of two wars abroad, dangers in Pakistan, and other problems, and Supreme Court nomination, to a moment in American history like Some would say Lyndon Johnson's early presidency, which was a little calmer, not much, but a little calmer. A president is juggling always just many, many issues, and they have to think about the politics in which they choose and how they handle each, the policy in terms of kind of what will work, what will just be a failure from the start. And it's an extraordinarily difficult job. And I think presidents always come out of their administrations grayer than when they started for a reason.
Yeah, and it happens pretty fast. You can already see a little more gray in his hair, can't you?
No, absolutely. Yeah. It's you know, the more you, again, the more you study them and really hear what life is like, again, either party, it's a pretty brutal process to try to govern.
How do you think he's doing so far?
I think he's doing well. I think, you know, stabilizing the economy was mission number one, and the economy is not good, and it's still, you know, on the brink of bad, but it's stable. I mean, we were in a sense, I think, when he came in, that there was no bottom, that we didn't know where this would end and how it would end. And I think more Americans are kind of sensing things are calm and some of the stimulus is working, some of the regulations are starting to create a better stock market, and that the government won't allow things to fall apart. Abroad, I think there's a lot of instability. I think Afghanistan and Pakistan are where many White House advisors have their eyes, and we don't know what he'll do there and how it will unfold. But overall, I think, you know, he gets decent points right now. He's doing well. His popularity is good, and he's put forth some very big policies, and he's gotten them through Congress. So, you know, that's a decent measure.
Sure. Professor Zelizer, I just love having you as a guest. You're so darn good. Thank you very much for being with us, and we look forward to our next conversation. Thanks
for having me.
Our guest, Professor Julian Zelizer, he's so good, isn't he? The hour always flies by when he's on. He's professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. He also does a lot of commentaries for CNN.com. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, to John Treader for on-air production, and thanks to you, everybody, for your interesting and important calls.